From NPR News, this is Foreign Dispatch, a weekly roundup of some of the best coverage of news and events filed by NPR's correspondents from around the globe. I'm Kevin Beasley. This week, a blow to North Korea's pride, why some Syrian army deserters don't want to fight for either side, and trying to be a pop star in South Korea. North Korea invited the world's press to witness its grand gesture, a rocket launch to commemorate its founder, Kim Il-sung. Instead, the event became a mortifying failure. The rocket broke apart just moments after takeoff and fell into the sea. While North Korea insisted the launch was peaceful, the international community condemned the move as a provocation. And now North Korea is being accused of violating UN Security Council resolutions. NPR's Louisa Lim sent this report from Seoul.
As North Korea launched its rocket, its state-run television was showing a video for a song called Roasted Chestnuts. So North Koreans were spared the humiliation of seeing their rocket exploding in midair about a minute after launch. But several hours later, normal programming was interrupted on North Korean television for an unusual announcement. The Earth observation satellite failed to enter orbit, the grim-faced announcer said. Scientists, technicians and experts are now searching for the cause of the failure. This was an unprecedented moment of honesty. When the past two rocket launches failed, Pyongyang simply lied to its people. But having invited the international press in, such a pretense was impossible this time. And there is likely to be domestic fallout. Jasper Kim from UI University in Seoul says this bungled launch could pose a crisis for North Korea's untested young leader, Kim Jong-un, who took over suddenly after his father's death in December.
What it does do in the short run is put an extreme amount of pressure on Kim Jong-un. This is the last thing he wanted. He wanted basically to bask in the glory of all these major accomplishments in front of the international community and the press. But now it's the greatest embarrassment that North Korea has suffered, at least in this century, if not ever.
North Koreans have been practicing for months for massive celebrations to mark the 100th anniversary of the birth of their founder, Kim Il-sung. The launch was supposed to be the centerpiece of that, a matter of intense pride and patriotism. Speaking before the launch, Shin Ju-hyun, the chief editor of the Daily NK, had warned any failure could unleash internal conflicts.
With any failure of the rocket launch, there's so much possibility that unseen conflicts and power struggles inside the regime could emerge.
In South Korea, a defense ministry official warned parliament that the possibility of a nuclear test, Pyongyang's third, or of other provocations is very high. Peter Beck from the Asia Foundation in Seoul says this failure is likely to make Pyongyang more belligerent.
North Korea has to prove itself to the world, the West and the rest, that it can move forward and unimpeded despite this failure. I think we're entering into a new era of provocation by the North because it's been so embarrassed in front of the international community.
So far, the international reaction has been fast and furious. Condemnation from world leaders who see this as a covert test of missile technology. White House press spokesman Jay Carney accused Pyongyang of wasting its money on weapons and propaganda displays while its people go hungry. The US says it will cancel plans for food aid for the North. And the UN Security Council will meet this morning to discuss the next step. But as the past has shown, the international community is lacking tools to deal with Pyongyang, according to North Korea expert Andrei Lankov at Kukmin University. He says a slap on the wrist from the UN would mean nothing to Pyongyang.
Why should they care? Sanctions are not working, partially because China is not going to join sanctions sincerely. Strategic patience is not going to work. Engagement is not going to work as well. What is going to work? Honest answer is nothing.
But that unpalatable truth will not stop the hours of diplomatic to and fro. In Pyongyang, they're still preparing for their Sunday celebrations. But the failure of this rocket will mean it's less a show of triumphalism than one of defiance. Louisa Lim, NPR News, Seoul.
Coming up, why Syrian military deserters don't want to fight for either side, and trying to be a pop star in South Korea. Ever since the uprising began in Syria last year, there have been many stories about soldiers who've deserted from the Syrian army to join the rebels. But not all soldiers who leave the army decide to join the insurgency. The deserters offer a rare glimpse into a military they say is committing unspeakable atrocities and a rebel force that's fighting back with its own brutality. NPR's Kelly McEvers sent this report.
Once a guy turns 18 in Syria, he's required to serve in the military. A man we recently met started his service about a year ago, right about the same time the Syrian uprising began. He calls himself Maxim. He's Kurdish. He has green eyes, a short beard, and gel in his hair. In those early days of the uprising, last spring, when thousands of Syrians began protesting in the streets, Maxim's commanders told him the protests were actually a conspiracy by a Saudi prince to turn Syria into an Islamic state. For a while, the soldiers believed it. Maxim says he was part of a special forces unit known as the shock team.
We usually break into the area at 4 in the morning, when the people are asleep. We would search the area house by house, store by store, and we had a list of the wanted people with us.
Those lists came from the dreaded security forces, who are not part of the army, but rather belong to one of more than a dozen of Syria's intelligence agencies. Maxim and his comrades turned the suspects over to security forces. He says many were tortured, some were killed. Maxim says he and his comrades started to doubt the regime's story. They found it hard to believe that all these people, including old men, women, and children, were actually armed militants trying to establish an Islamic state. Instead, he says, when the people did start fighting back, it was to protect themselves. One day, one of Maxim's friends, a fellow soldier, was shot by one of these rebels in the Syrian town of Rastan. His colonel ordered Maxim and his comrades to search a house where four suspects lived. They found a sniper rifle and two Kalashnikovs, but the colonel didn't stop there.
He forced them to walk on the street, and wherever they went, they arrested more people. If your name on the list, come. If your name on the list, come. Until the total number became 30.
Maxim says the 30 men were lined up and blindfolded, and their hands were bound behind their backs. They were told to kneel, and the colonel and two of his bodyguards shot them all dead. The colonel explained his actions to the nearly 100 soldiers who watched.
We have to take a revenge for our comrades. These are all bad people anyway, and they don't suit this town anymore.
When the commanding general of the unit heard about the killings, Maxim says he ordered the men to just leave the bodies where they lay. Later, some of Maxim's comrades decided to get back at the general. They tipped off some people in Rostan one day, told them to block the general's car with a large truck.
They cut off the road at the end of the bridge.
Three soldiers climbed on top of the truck, fired at the general, and killed him. Both of these stories, about the killing of the 30 men and the killing of the commanding general, have been verified by residents of Rostan. When soldiers like Maxim decide to leave the army, they pay money to a network of smugglers who basically get them out of Syria. They cross rivers in the middle of the night. They climb over hills. They eventually end up here in this valley in Iraqi Kurdistan in what's becoming a kind of refugee camp. Right now there's probably three dozen young and middle-aged men playing a pretty rowdy game of volleyball. And just beyond that is where the soldiers end up sleeping in two unfinished cinder block buildings. We walk up to the building to see how many men are inside. There's no windows, only tarps, sleeping side by side on mattresses on the floor. But they say, you know, the situation they were in back in Syria, if you were either in the army or about to be in the army, you either prefers to kill or to be killed. And so this is a better alternative than that. Oh, wow. This is another huge hall, unfinished hall. And this is definitely 100 guys all in here, all young men, sitting around, smoking, laying on their mattresses, crowded around heaters, drinking tea. It's pretty staggering just to see so many people, so many faces all in one place.
Guys crowd around us to talk about why they left the army. They forced us to detain people, to shoot people, they say. These are our brothers. We couldn't stay in this army and do this to our brothers. Outside the hall, one guy pulls us aside and says he wants to talk in private. He says he was working a checkpoint when security forces stopped a car, pulled a man out to be interrogated, got into the car, and harassed the man's wife and sister.
We heard shouting and crying from the car, especially the little one, the sister.
The next day, the officers who'd entered the car bragged that they raped the women. UN officials say these atrocities could amount to war crimes. Right now, though, they aren't pushing for a referral to the International Criminal Court. Instead, they hope they can convince the Syrian regime to abide by a ceasefire that's supposed to start this week. When Maxim finally decided to leave the Syrian army, he and 10 other soldiers faked a firefight with rebels to make their escape. They fired their own guns in the air. Maxim's officer radioed in to see what was happening.
I told him we are facing resistance here, and we ask us, where are you? I cut off the call. So they think we were kidnapped.
We asked Maxim why he didn't join the rebels once he'd escaped. I'm not sure about them, he says. At first, they were just defending themselves. But now it seems like the regime's myth is coming true. These rebels are starting to be more violent and more Islamic. I don't trust them. Still, Maxim says the regime is worse than the rebels. We ask him if the killing of 30 men in retaliation for the killing of one soldier is an apt ratio. In other words, are the regime's crimes 30 times worse than the crimes of the rebels? No, he says. They are 100 times worse. Kelly McEvers, NPR News.
South Korean pop music, known as K-pop, is massively popular in many Asian countries. And even if it's practically unknown here, it's spreading like wildfire in a vast new market, China. The all-girl and all-boy groups that sing and dance to K-pop music can earn millions. One of the most successful groups, Girls Generation, made its US debut on The Late Show with David Letterman earlier this year. The appearance didn't bring the 9 female singers instant fame in America, but it boosted their image back home, and it made thousands more teenagers determined to copy their success. From Seoul, Diwali Zaikautal reports.
Inside a nondescript building on Seoul's Rodeo Drive sit dozens of teenagers, some with their parents. They're taking part in open auditions held by entertainment giant SM. Guess whose music is playing? Bring the boys out, girls. It's the Girls' Generation hit song, The Boys. The same song they performed on Letterman, the same song that's been viewed on YouTube a gazillion times. There's no question 16-year-old Young Eun Park idolizes them.
When I see Girls' Generation, I think they're so pretty and so cool. I'm going to be just like them.
She's got zero formal training, but she's hoping to wow the judges by singing Ballerino by another K-pop group, Lee Sang. It's her third audition, and she's hopeful this time she'll get a call back.
I live only to sing and dance. If I don't become a singer, I won't be happy in my life. I want it so bad.
She's almost tearful, but then looks up with determination and says she's going to give it her all. 19-year-old Rebecca Chu flew in from Taiwan. She thinks she's got a shot too, since a few famous K-pop stars are nationals from China, Thailand, and the U.S.
I come to Korea because the YG audition, and I just buy the ticket and fly here. Because it's my dream, I want to make them come true.
She says she especially loves the dance moves that go along with just about every K-pop hit, though she admits she doesn't understand the Korean words in the songs.
Just a little. I can read and I can pronounce, but I don't know the meaning.
But not to worry. If the top entertainment companies like her, not only will they invest in her study of the Korean language, but they'll spend up to $3 or $4 million on years of rigorous training in song, dance, acting, and more. If she gets through that, then maybe she'll have a shot at multiple contracts worth millions of dollars.
본스타 트레이닝 센터에서는 한국 엔터테인먼트 산업을 이끌어갈
That's the advertising single of Bornstar Training Center, a company in Seoul that trains young people to become K-pop stars. CEO Hong Ki-sung says he's helping to mold the next generation.
네, 지금도 굉장히 많은 아이들이 있어요. 굉장히 많아요.
There are so many young, talented people in Korea, so many that I can't even count them. And they're better singers than a lot of the stars out there now.
Some K-pop groups have even more members than Girls' Generation. But Hong says not all the performers have good singing voices.
외형적인 걸 맞추려고 하다 보면
Appearance is important too. That's why there are so many pretty girls and stylish boys in K-pop bands. Even though some people in the K-pop groups can't sing well, they have other strengths.
너만 바라본 많은 날들
As the students prepare for their next audition, they know the road ahead is not going to be easy. The young people are well aware that thousands and thousands of South Korean kids are trying to get into the K-pop business, and most will fail. Next door, teenager Lim Ji-hae is only on her third day at the training center.
정말 얼마 안 됐지만 열심히
I'm going to do my best and train hard to become a great performer.
Maybe she won't succeed in the music world, she says, but she'd love to be an actress. And then, she says, she can play any role she wants, including being a K-pop singer. For NPR News, I'm Doahli Saikautau in Seoul.
For more international coverage, you can listen to your local NPR station. You'll find a list at our website, npr.org. And while you're there, you can find more international stories by clicking on News and World. For NPR News, I'm Kevin Beasley.